Hi, I'm Shirin Jafari. I'm a reporter for The World, where I often cover the Middle East. Recently, I've been on the ground covering the ongoing war in Ukraine. Take my recent coverage about Russia's strategy of targeting Ukraine's infrastructure using drone attacks. Or my interview with Victoria Abidina, a young Ukrainian medic and mother who spent 6 months as a prisoner of war before finally being released earlier this fall. You may already know this, but it takes a lot of work to bring stories like this to you. Even a segment that's only a few minutes long is built on months, sometimes years, of establishing sources and building relationships. This work is crucial, and it's crucial that we do it well. But we can't do it without financial support from listeners like you. From now through December 31st, The World is participating in Newsmatch, a fundraising movement for nonprofit newsrooms like ours. We recently learned that a generous donor has offered to match gifts to The World before December 31st up to $67,000. But we need to raise that entire amount to unlock the match. We have a long way to go. I really hope you consider supporting our work so we can keep on bringing The World to you. You can learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you. And now, the show.
In Germany, a far-right plot to overthrow the government.
The conspiracy theories are ridiculous, but the actions and the plans are deadly serious.
Raids and arrests across Germany today. I'm Marco Werman. Also, African soccer clubs change up their coaching model.
What African teams would do often is they would hire a European coach. People would complain that these coaches were like mercenaries.
This year at the World Cup, teams led by African coaches are thriving. And the blue marble image of planet Earth, taken 50 years ago today by Apollo 17, former astronaut Mae Jemison tells us about seeing the marble for real.
Having Africa in the center made a really big difference. You know, we sort of saw different continents as not being as big a part of this world. And that put us clearly together.
A recalibrating photograph and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. Early this morning, thousands of German special forces fanned out across the country, a massive raid to dismantle a far-right group plotting to overthrow the government. At the center of it all, Heinrich the 13th. A German prince disowned by his aristocratic family, the House of Reuss. His capture was caught on camera. Heinrich is seen wearing a tan blazer. The 71-year-old's wrists are cuffed as police frog-walked him to a van. The group's plan was to storm Germany's parliament and install Heinrich as Germany's new leader, a monarch. Stranger than fiction, and it runs even deeper. Jeff Rathke is president of the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's in Germany right now. Give us a sense of scale, Jeff. Just how vast and spread out was this raid today?
Well, this is one of the largest coordinated law enforcement actions in German history, certainly in recent decades. About 3,000 police officials involved. They searched 150 different locations in 11 states out of Germany's 16 states. And then there were also some raids in Italy and elsewhere for other suspects. Around 25 arrests and a total of 51 suspects. So you get a sense there that this is a broad network of people and not just a couple of isolated individuals.
How shocking a morning was this for Germans?
Well, I don't want to go too far with the analogy, but you know, you think about the scope of this and the plans that these people had, and this sounds in some ways a little bit like January 6th, doesn't it? You have people who were ready to use force to try to take over and invade the seat of Germany's legislature and really taken everyone by surprise for the scope and the details of what they had in mind.
And what do we know about who was arrested? What kind of people are they?
Well, there's not a lot of personal detail on many of them, but some of the contours we can see. You mentioned Heinrich von Reuss, who is from a former noble family. Also, apparently, at least one ex-officer of the German Special Forces who was arrested, as well as a non-commissioned officer, at least one police official. And this is particularly interesting, one former member of parliament from the extreme right party called the Alternative for Germany, a woman who was in parliament from 2017 until 2021 and was among those arrested. She apparently was supposed to become a sort of justice minister for this coup government, and she was indeed a sitting judge.
Right. AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, was previously put under surveillance, but they still got pretty far with these plans. What does all this say about this far-right underground movement and their connection to elected lawmakers?
Well, there's not any other evidence yet of connections to sitting lawmakers, but it is the case that the AfD party has moved in a more and more extreme direction over recent years. So I think that is one of the most important factors to follow up on here in the coming days and weeks as these cases move forward.
Those people who were arrested today, was there a group they were all working for?
The group of people arrested today are alleged to have been part of a conspiracy to take over state authority. These are people who apparently deny the legitimacy of the existing German state. And so they had a number of different functions. One was military to use allegedly private security firms to seize power. And then there were also the rudiments of a governmental organization, which these conspiracists had come up with in order to take over civil administration. You know, the conspiracy theories are ridiculous, but the actions and the plans are deadly serious.
You mentioned these people believe Germany's government is illegitimate. Do they have an ideology?
An ideology might be too generous a word, but these are people who believe that essentially the monarchist government, which was in place until 1918, was never legally replaced and that it still continues to exist, or at least that the current constitution and government are illegitimate. So that's one thing that alleged ringleader Heinrich von Reuss talked about openly. In German, they're called the Reichsbürger, the imperial citizens.
Would you say in the past there was a level of denial that German officials had over the possibility of far-right violence?
I think there was a recognition that it was a problem, but never a recognition of the full potential scope, and not asking enough questions and not pursuing these connections to the full end.
Just extraordinary news, Jeff. What has captured your attention the most about all of this?
Well, one aspect of this, which I think is tantalizing, is an allegation that the ringleader, Heinrich von Reuss, made contact with Russian officials. Russian authorities have denied having had any contact. And even in the German prosecutor's statement today, he goes to the trouble of pointing out that they have no evidence that that Russia reacted in any way to this attempted contact.
Jeff Rathke is president of the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He joined us today from Berlin. Jeff, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Officials in Turkey say they are preparing for another ground invasion of northern Syria. They're targeting an area currently controlled by Kurdish allies of the United States. Turkey says it's going after the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, a separatist group that Turkish leaders are blaming for a deadly bombing in Istanbul last month. The PKK has denied any involvement. Turkey's incursion has human rights groups warning that it could trigger a new exodus of refugees and worsen an already dire humanitarian crisis in northern Syria. From Istanbul, the world's Duri Buscarin reports.
Days after a bomb ripped through a busy shopping area in Istanbul, the Turkish military began a widespread air assault on northern Syria. Shells struck grain silos, a power station, and a hospital, as well as military targets. Onlookers captured the destruction on camera. Ishak, a Syriac Christian shop owner living near the Turkish border, watched the airstrikes in the distance as he stood on the roof of his house last week. You don't know what's going to be targeted, so you don't know where to go, he says. There are no words to describe it. It's fear. Ishak says people stay home these days. Kids have been taken out of school. Mosques and churches are empty. When you target the infrastructure, you target the stability of an area, he says. It's all a pretext, not to let us live in peace and freedom like other human beings in the world. Turkish officials say the strikes are targeting terrorist groups responsible for the Istanbul bombing. On Twitter, the Ministry of Defense called it payback time.
Of course, we had to respond.
In a lengthy sit-down interview with Al Jazeera, Turkish presidential spokesman Ibrahim Kalin said that investigators had clearly linked the Istanbul bombing to affiliates of the PKK.
Any and all PKK, PYD, YPG establishments, elements, posts, military points are legitimate targets for us, whether they are in western Syria or in eastern Syria, northern Syria, near the border or far away from it. They are legitimate targets because they are terrorist organizations. And we go after them to protect our borders.
The U.S. plays a complicated role in all this. It agrees with Turkey that the PKK is a terrorist group, which has waged a guerrilla war in Turkey's southeast since the 1980s, often from outposts in Iraq and Syria. But the U.S. has also backed an umbrella group of Syrian militias, known as the Syrian Democratic Forces, to fight the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS. Turkey considers these groups, including the PYD and the YPG, to be affiliates of the PKK, and that's where they have a problem with the U.S.
You see, PYD, YPG is using, at one point, the American flag, at another point, the regime flag to protect itself, saying that, you see, you cannot attack us because there are Americans here. That, I think, shows the extent to which PYD, YPG is using their alliance with the United States to legitimate their own presence in northern Syria.
Other analysts say Turkey has a point. Gregory Waters, a Syrian analyst for the crisis group, says there's been a lot of movement between the PKK and the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF.
When I look at the Turkish drone strikes in northeast Syria, many of those strikes are hitting PKK commanders. Whether they are still actively in the central PKK or they have, over the last years, moved on to roles in the SDF or YPG, there's plenty of evidence showing that many of these people were, for decades, senior members of the PKK who have been wanted by Turkey for decades.
About 900 U.S. troops are still deployed in Syria, many of them sharing bases with the SDF. In the early days of the Turkish air assault, one missile landed within 150 yards of U.S. troops, the Pentagon confirmed. The real question, Waters says, is whether these missile strikes are achieving what Turkey wants to accomplish, a safer country.
Absent of any sort of peace process or diplomatic initiative, these sorts of just, you know, constantly hitting the PKK and the PKK hitting Turkey back, it just gets stuck in the cycle.
A cycle where countless civilians could be caught in the crossfire. That's why human rights groups are calling on the U.S. and other countries to intervene to stop a Turkish invasion. It would be the fourth military operation by Turkish-backed forces in northern Syria, which already control a large swath of land along the border. Bassam al-Ahmad, the executive director of Syrians for Truth and Justice, is originally from the northern Syrian border city of Qamishli. He fears that Turkish-backed forces will show little mercy in a ground invasion.
The speech they are saying, many of the times they don't distinguish or they mix between like the fighters and the people.
Al-Ahmad says he's in daily contact with family members in northern Syria who have packed their bags and are ready to flee.
Especially by the Turkish officials. So the way that they speak about this area, they always use this kind of like terms of genocide, you know, saying that we will clean, saying that we will kill, we will destroy.
Turkey has not set a clear timeline for a new ground assault in northern Syria, but its leaders say it could come at any time. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin in Istanbul.
Today, the northern tip of Greenland is a barren Arctic desert. 2 million years ago, it was a lush, verdant landscape, trees, vegetation, animals, even mastodons. That's the conclusion from a study of environmental DNA, genetic material taken from soil samples. Researchers published a study today in the journal Nature. In it, they compared DNA that had been shed into the environment 2 million years ago with that of different species, looking for matches. The DNA fragments suggest a mix of Arctic plants like birch trees and willow shrubs with ones that usually prefer warmer climates, including firs and cedars. Lead author Kurt Kier says, quote, "The study opens the door into a past that has basically been lost." You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In our Boston studio, there's a flag that features that famous picture of planet Earth taken by the crew of the Apollo 17 moon rocket, which launched 50 years ago today.
All engines are started. We have ignition. 2-1-0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff. And
the image of Earth in that photo would become known as the Blue Marble. People could actually see what this small, life-sustaining planet looks like from afar. The photo captured the imagination of Mae Jemison. She, of course, would become an astronaut herself, the first woman of color to travel into space. She served as mission specialist on board the Space Shuttle Endeavour in 1992. These days, Mae Jemison leads the 100-Year Starship Project, a nonprofit whose hope is to launch interstellar travel within 100 years. Dr. Jemison joins us from Houston. Hello.
Hello. This is an exciting day. 50 years ago, huh?
I would love it if you could share a personal anecdote or recollection about that iconic blue marble photograph 50 years ago. What do you remember about seeing that picture for the first time?
I don't have a single recollection. I knew that the Earth was a marble, right? I knew that it was this circular thing. What I do remember, because I was in high school at that time, what I do remember is seeing the continent of Africa shown so clearly, and the size and the fact that here was this planet that was so much, you know, all about where we live. And for me, having Africa in the center made a really big difference, because it was during that time when, you know, we sort of saw different continents, different countries as not being as big a part of this world. And that put us clearly together. That's what I remember about it.
So speaking of confirmation, what was that like when you go up in space, 1992, you're on Endeavour, and you see for yourself the actual big blue marble? Did it look like the photo? I mean, just emotionally, what was going through your head?
Well, unfortunately, the shuttle only goes up to low Earth orbit, so you see the arc of the Earth, and you see the thin layer of atmosphere that's just a shining, shimmering blue. The images that are most vivid for me are the going across the Horn of Africa, crossing the Nile Delta, and there's this just shimmering light that comes off of the desert. And I recognize that at one point in time, I had been at the Nile Delta, right? I'd been in Egypt. When I thought about the Earth, I thought about the fact that it's in space, right? That right now we're in space, and it formed my connection with the rest of the universe. It wasn't just sort of looking and thinking how small I am. It really was an expansive feeling to me that I am as much a part of this greater universe as any speck of stardust. Mm-hmm. And that was what happened with me when I was on the shuttle. If there was a change, the confirmation was around being a part of this greater universe and belonging here.
You're seeing that thin layer of atmosphere, as you called it. I mean, in some ways, I am guessing that could have been more pronounced in terms of your reaction than the photograph.
Well, that thin layer of atmosphere supports our life, right? That's where our life comes from. And for me, the confirmation was that, you know, we as humans have this incredible home and we are taking very good care of it, and that the Earth will be here, but we may not be here if we continue to treat it in such a way that it doesn't support our life form.
I'm speaking with Dr. Mae Jemison, astronaut, engineer, physician. You've retired from NASA, but you're still obviously an avid supporter of space exploration, to wit, your 100-year Starship project. Can you explain what that is?
So 100-year Starship was seed funded by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the premier Defense Department agency, to really jumpstart radical innovations in technology, human systems, and interstellar flight, interstellar travel is nothing like going around in our solar system. Voyager, which has been traveling at over 35,000 miles per hour since 1977, just left our solar system. If it were headed toward our closest neighboring star, Alpha Centauri, which is 4.2 light years away, it would take it 50 to 60,000 years to get there. So we have to do something very differently. The energy requirements to do human interstellar flight are phenomenal, to do any interstellar flight in a reasonable period of time. The idea around sustainability is really important. How do you reuse things? How do you put them together? Those are really important. Navigation, IT, human behavior, how do you invest in something over a long time? And if you think about that, that really mirrors the challenges that we face in this world today on this planet.
I'd really love to ask you then, why is it so important that we make, as you say, that audacious journey to outer space, especially when there's still so much to do on Earth, which is kind of the subtext of that famous photo?
With 100 Year Starship, we believe pursuing an extraordinary tomorrow creates a better world today. We are able to reach villages. We're able to see things and understand things about the Earth and our environment because of space exploration. Every day we walk around with space receivers in our hand in the form of our smartphones that give us GPS readings and other things, the miniaturization, the issues around how do we observe the body. There are so many things that we take for granted that are very much involved in doing something as extraordinary as going to the moon and coming back. And so without pushing further, without having a challenge of things that we don't know how to do, sometimes we stagnate.
That intersection of space and culture. I gather you once made an appearance, Dr. Jemison, on an episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation. So I got to ask, are you a Trekkie? Please say it is so.
I never call myself a Trekkie, but I am a huge Star Trek fan from the original series on. And I'm really proud to say that I think, you know, pop culture people sometimes consider it, you know, irrelevant, but it changes our perspectives. And that's the reason why something like Star Trek, which had a very positive outlook on our future, it represented in the 1960s the full range of humanity on board the Enterprise. And that gave us another view, another look. I can tell you that I assumed I would go into space before I saw Nichelle Nichols, before I saw George Takei on the bridge of the Enterprise. I always assumed I would go into space. But here were confirmations that other people believed, like I did, that we all belong there.
Well, Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura on Star Trek, I mean, a woman of color in space, you were the first woman of color to actually travel into space. How significant was that for you, Dr. Jemison, and for young people of color, do you think?
For me, you know, I had a job to do. It was, you know, highly personal. But on the other hand, you also recognize that you have a platform. And what do you do with that platform? For me, it was about, even then, including other people. So I took up with me in space, because astronauts are allowed to take up different souvenirs. I took up a picture of Judith Jameson from Alvin Ailey performing the dance Cry for all Black women everywhere. I took up a Bundu statue, B-U-N-D-U statue, from the Women's and Girls Society in West Africa. I took up a certificate for Chicago public school students to promise to do well in math and science. It was duplicated and handed out to the other students, all the students in Chicago when I came back. That's where I went to school, at Chicago Public Schools. I took up an Alpha Kappa Alpha banner, which is the oldest African-American women's sorority in the country. I took up a flag for the Organization of African Unity because I wanted to include people and hand these things back to folks who may not have been included. That's what I wanted to do. So when you ask me, what does that mean to me? It meant bringing my ideas and knowledge to bear on problems, questions, and solutions, which meant that after I left, that Project 100 Year Starship had to start with inclusive, right? Across ethnicity, gender, geography, across disciplines, that it had to help improve life here on Earth and beyond. And it had to be audacious because we need adrenaline. I think that's one of the things that's really important is I recognize that humans need an adrenaline rush. You know, we need to have a challenge. And what bigger challenge than space exploration and using it to improve life here on Earth as well as beyond?
Mae Jemison, engineer, physician, and former NASA astronaut. She currently leads a 100-year Starship project, a nonprofit whose mission is that humans will travel beyond our solar system within 100 years. Dr. Jemison, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me and loving the blue marble.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Coming up on the show, a UN conference in Montreal wants to slow the die-off of plants and animals with an agreement that aims to do nothing short of realigning the relationship between humans and our environment.
We have to rethink our attitudes to nature, the way we value it. This is really the moment. We can't wait any longer.
And at the World Cup, the new fortunes for African soccer still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Peru swore in a new president this afternoon, former Vice President Dina Boluarte. This comes after a dramatic day in Lima. The former president, Pedro Castillo, tried to dissolve Congress ahead of a vote to impeach him. Castillo was then detained by police, and Congress voted to oust him anyway, replacing him with his second in command. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Dina Boluarte was sworn in front of Congress.
Tengo el alto honor de estar en este pleno extraordinario.
The 60-year-old becomes the first female president of Peru. Boluarte said her first order of business would be to address government corruption. She called what happened an attempted coup that has not found an echo in the institutions or in the streets. Boluarte called for a political truce to install a national unity government. Her swearing-in caps a day of political uncertainty. It started when former President Pedro Castillo took to the airwaves to dissolve Congress before they had a chance to impeach him.
Atención al reclamo ciudadano a lo largo y ancho del país.
He said he was installing an emergency government until a new Congress could be elected. Castillo was elected a little over a year ago. In that time, Congress tried to impeach him twice and failed. But today, they succeeded. Lawmakers met in defiance of the president, singing the national anthem before voting him out. This was a gamble by Castillo. He was hoping he had the support of his party to stay in power, but his ministers and allies deserted him. Only six lawmakers in the end voted against impeachment. Peru has been rocked by political instability. Since 2011, Peruvians have lived under seven presidents and seen four ex-leaders detained or wanted on corruption charges. Castillo himself is the subject of six criminal investigations. He's accused of leading a criminal organization with lawmakers and family members to profit off government contracts. Castillo denies wrongdoing. Castillo was seen leaving the presidential palace just after Congress voted to impeach him. He was reportedly taken into police custody. Earlier in the day, some were worried that the army would step in to support the president. But for the moment, it looks like a real crisis has been averted. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
A powerful and polarizing politician in Argentina is now looking at a six-year prison sentence. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner served as the country's president for 12 years. Yesterday, she was handed the court verdict on a corruption case. Kirchner is probably Argentina's most influential political figure of the past two decades. She is the current vice president. Now she's been found guilty of fraudulent administration. Essentially, in her case, that means awarding public contracts to a friend, something Kirchner denies.
Esto es un estado paralelo y mafia.
Kirchner addressed the country after the news broke and said she's a victim of a judicial mafia controlled by the right-wing opposition. These accusations are fiction, she said, part of a bad and false script. Kirchner is a divisive figure in Argentina. The country is politically split between her leftist movement called Kirchnerismo and her critics who say she's responsible for ruining the economy. The rate of inflation in Argentina is one of the highest in the world. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner still has a lot of supporters. Once the verdict hit the news yesterday, a crowd gathered in front of the National Congress in Buenos Aires chanting Cristina for president. Kirchner says she will not run for election next year, and if the charges against her hold up in court, she will be banned from political office for life. It's not likely she will face prison time. Kirchner's position as vice president gives her immunity, and the appeals process could take years. In China, protests have diminished after the loosening of some COVID restrictions. But in nearby Taiwan, support continues for what's been called the A4 revolution across the water in the People's Republic. Taiwanese lawmakers like Su Xiaohui have been speaking out. Su said, "We're all striving for a free system. This is a clash between democracy and authoritarianism. If we don't stand up today, we might be next." That's one take, but as Ashish Valentine reports from Taipei, there's a range of reactions to the tumult in China.
Last Sunday, in downtown Taipei, dozens of people gathered in front of the city's famous Liberty Square Arch holding A4-sized pieces of paper. Li Mingqiu is a Taiwanese activist who spent 5 years locked up in China. When there's a democratic movement by the people of another country to resist authoritarianism, as a human being you should support it. In this case, the country is so close to us and claims every day it will invade Taiwan by force. At these events, the atmosphere is usually solemn, and activists, local politicians, and students take turns making short speeches. Vivian Chun is a 22-year-old student at National Taiwan University. She's been to many of these events and says she's surprised to see Taiwanese people who don't often agree coming together.
Some believe they're Chinese, so it is also Chinese people are suffering. But I also see a lot, especially younger generation, like we think Taiwan is an independent country. However, human rights is a universal value, so we come together.
Chen says many Taiwanese are surprised to see people from mainland China speak up for human rights and support Taiwan's sovereignty.
They are very in support of these movements, but because of the political atmosphere, they cannot say that out loud.
Chen says events like these might begin to create mutual understanding. Ho Ming-so is a sociologist at National Taiwan University. He says Taiwanese people have long voiced their support for democracy in China, but for different reasons. Back in 1989, when Chinese troops opened fire on protesters in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, Taiwan was also still governed by authoritarian Chinese nationalists who emphasized that Chinese and Taiwanese are all one people.
It was seen as a tragedy of the nation that young aspiration for democracy had been dashed. So the whole blood is thicker than water narrative was quite dominant in the early 90s.
Ho says that many in the older generation still feel this connection with China. But after Taiwan democratized in the 1990s and China stayed authoritarian, Taiwan's local identity has become stronger, with each generation identifying more as only Taiwanese. Ho says when he talks to young protesters, like those who supported Hong Kong in 2019, he notices them approaching these movements for different reasons.
The more emphasis is on fighting against authoritarianism. We all want democracy. So there is no emphasis on the blood, ethnic, the racial tie.
Lev Nachman is a political scientist at National Chungchi University in Taipei. He says while these events are helping some Taiwanese people better understand Chinese perspectives, it's doubtful they'll have a big impact on China. That said, Nachman thinks Taiwan should protect Chinese students here who are speaking out.
I think it's incredibly brave of them to be so public about it, because even though they're in Taiwan, if they do participate in these kinds of events, someone back in China is probably finding out.
He says some more conservative corners of Taiwanese society have argued against supporting these protests, essentially because what happens in China should have nothing to do with Taiwan. For now, though, many Taiwanese are paying close attention. For the world, this is Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
Chinese President Xi Jinping stepped down from an Air China jet onto the tarmac in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia this morning. He was greeted with a cannon salute and a flyover of fighter jets with vapor trails in the red and yellow of China's national flag. It's only Xi's third overseas trip since the pandemic started. It came at the invitation of the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. China is one of Saudi Arabia's biggest oil customers, but there's likely to be more to talk about than oil. Robert Mogilnicki is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute. He's been following this trip from Washington. Robert, Mohammed bin Salman invited President Xi. What does the Saudi leader want?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman wants to be viewed as a statesman, and ultimately he wants to project power on the international stage. And I think we see similar needs and desires with President Xi. He's looking to also be treated as a statesman and have the red carpet rolled out for him in a region where Chinese officials think is a playground for superpowers, and that is the Middle East. And that's why I see this trip taking place at this time.
And what will President Xi be looking to accomplish this week in that playground, as he say? What does he want from Riyadh?
Well, he wants to essentially strengthen relations. And I believe that these relations are ultimately economic in nature. That is the number one, the primary core, so to speak, has to do with energy and energy relations. We know Saudi Arabia is one of the most important energy producers in the world and supplies China with a considerable degree of its energy needs. The second tier of that kind of pattern has to do with trade and investment. And we're actually seeing a lot of cooperation in the tech sphere. Saudi Arabia has, you know, incredibly ambitious technological projects and strategies and initiatives in place. China has a lot to offer on that front. And I expect that's one area where the two sides will be discussing very, very closely at the summit.
Well, we know China's Belt and Road Initiative has created a network of rail and maritime ports all over the globe. It does not really include Saudi Arabia, though. Is that about to change?
I don't think it's going to change on a broad level, but if we look toward the Red Sea region, this is an area where Saudi Arabia is investing tremendous resources to develop luxury tourism offerings along the coast and also to enhance the commercial capacity of that region, both within Saudi Arabia and in neighboring countries. This is an area that is really at the heart of the Belt and Road Initiative, at least as it applies to the Middle East region.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because in Saudi Arabia, she will also be meeting leaders from Oman, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Bahrain. What does Xi's visit mean for the region?
Over the past couple of years, there's been a tremendous degree of tensions in relations between the United States and a number of Arab governments. And we've seen concerted efforts by Gulf Arab governments to grow a network of partners to convey the idea that they have other options and that Washington is not their only other option. And this sends a very clear message to Washington.
I mean, you're right. The Saudi-U.S. relationship has been built on oil and on U.S. security. Military cooperation has been crucial. Is this meeting the first step in that balance kind of getting unbalanced?
At the moment, I'm not of the of the group that supports the idea that Arab countries like Saudi Arabia are moving away from the U.S. I think they're engaged in a very difficult balancing act between the U.S. and China and a number of other global partners. And the risk is that they lean too far in one direction and create the perception that they are actually, you know, moving away from traditional relationships. And I think that's a major risk that they have to be very careful not to overreach.
Robert Mogilnicki is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington and a lecturer at George Washington University focusing on China in the Middle East, helping us understand the high-profile visit of Chinese President Xi Jinping to Saudi Arabia. Thanks a lot, Robert.
Thank you.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau welcomed scientists and activists to Montreal this week with a stark message.
I don't have to tell any of you here this afternoon that nature is under threat. In fact, it's under attack.
They're gathering in Quebec for the United Nations Biodiversity Conference, tackling the unprecedented declines in a range of plant and animal species across the globe. Claire Shine is the CEO of the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership in the UK. She's heading to Montreal in a couple of days for the conference. What is the goal of this two-week-long meeting, Claire?
Hi, Marco. It's a critical moment to set a far bolder pathway for transformational change for people and nature. We have to rethink our attitudes to nature, the way we value it. And as Prime Minister Trudeau said, this is really the moment. We can't wait any longer.
What is the current state of global biodiversity? How dire is the situation?
Situation is really dire. We know now that a million species are threatened with extinction on sea and on land. But nature is so much more than species. A living, livable planet needs a really healthy web of life. And the stuff we take for granted depends on our natural systems working well. Think about what happens if our crops can't be effectively pollinated by bees, if wetlands can't absorb storms and floods, if we can't get fish from the sea. Those are just a few examples. And once those tipping points are reached, we're going to see the consequences in the quality of our life, in our wallets, in the way businesses can operate and innovate, and indeed where we can live.
Right. And these are very dynamic connections. And as you say, ultimately hitting us humans. So what kind of framework or deal are you hoping to see come out of this conference?
We talk so much about climate. I think many, many of your listeners will be familiar with this idea of 1.5 degrees as a rallying cry. So where's the same rallying cry for nature? We're keen to see now for this conference to deliver a really bold commitment for what we call 30 by 30, this image that 30% of the world's land and sea surfaces are properly protected by 2030.
So more than 90 heads of state have signed a pledge to preserve nature, but as of now, Justin Trudeau is the only world leader attending the summit in Quebec. What are your thoughts on so few leaders attending?
I'm really disappointed, and I'm an optimist, so I always hope things can turn around at the last minute. So I'm hoping that Prime Minister Trudeau, by being there and by speaking openly and powerfully, can prove to be a beacon. I think it's never too late, and I would love to see even a small number of political leaders who book those tickets, those air tickets at the last minute, and start to say, you know, this matters.
Well, ambitious biodiversity targets have been set before and the world failed to meet them. You said you're an optimist, Claire. What makes you think this time could be different?
I'm an optimist because I think people in our kind of work have a duty of hope to always look about how we can do things better. I think what has to change is it's systemic, Marco. We need now not to treat nature as a can we sort it out in an ad hoc way. We need to put nature at the heart of all future policy and regulations. And we also need to embed nature in decision making across business and finance. And that is transformative. This isn't a luxury. The kinds of jobs that the next generations will benefit from and will give them a far greater quality of life will need to be nature aligned and nature dependent. There is no business on a broken planet and no business in a broken society.
Claire Shine is CEO of the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership in the UK. She'll be at the UN Biodiversity Conference in Quebec in a few days. Claire, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Moroccans came out to party yesterday in the streets of their capital, Rabat. Also in London. And many other places in between, over the moon that their team knocked off mighty Spain at the Men's World Cup of Soccer. Another upset and another showcase for the rise of African soccer.
I mean, I was kind of shocked.
Sean Jacobs is an associate professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. He also runs the blog Africa is a Country.
I know that Morocco in 1986, they had gone to the round of 16 and they kept going until I think there was like more than a minute left. And then Germany scored a goal and that ended their last attempt to get into the quarterfinals. So this time they were playing against Spain, which is known for ball possession, you know, controlling the game. And somehow they prevented Spain from scoring a goal and they won the game. So for me, I mean, it's wonderful. There were five African teams in this World Cup. I had high hopes for all of them. Senegal and Morocco made it to the knockout rounds and Morocco's still in there. So good feelings, yeah.
I mean, one big storyline yesterday was that of Ashraf Hakimi, the son of Moroccan immigrants to Spain, and the player who shot the game-winning goal. I mean, it's such a Hollywood story, isn't it?
No, it's an incredible story, but it also indicates something about the growing influence of the diaspora, the ones who left. Many of these players would actually play for, say, France or Belgium or any other European team, Germany or Spain, but increasingly they're picking the teams of their parents. They want to play for the team of their parents. But I think there's more and more understanding of the kind of the idea of the nation, the boundaries of like, where does the nation end and begin? Take Ashraf Hakimi, for example. I mean, he's the son of very working class immigrant parents to Madrid. I think his mother was a domestic worker and his father sold fruit on the streets. And he was not going to break into the Spanish team. And we know that, you know, there's in terms of identity in those countries, they're not happy to have often these immigrant populations. So if your mom's home is calling, and you can see from the interactions with his mom in the crowd after a game when he runs up to hug her, that yeah, there's definitely the role of the diaspora has definitely grown in these countries. Yeah,
beyond Morocco, and you cited a few of the other teams: Senegal, Cameroon, mentioned Tunisia and Ghana as well. I mean, they've all played really, really well in this World Cup. What do they owe their success to, do you think?
I think local coaching is definitely something that played a role here. If people can remember in the past, what African teams would do often is they would hire a European coach, somebody often you've never heard of. In some cases, people would complain that these coaches were like mercenaries. They pop up in, you know, in somewhere in Asia, in the Caribbean and in Africa. And once the the World Cup is over, they're gone. Often they displace a local coach right before the World Cup. So this time around, I think there was a sense of investing in local coaches. I think there's a belief within these countries that we've gone to successive World Cups. You know, if we did qualify, you went usually with a European coach. The players often didn't get along with these coaches. For example, Ziyech, the star player of Morocco, the previous coach who's non-Moroccan, Eastern European coach, he didn't like Ziyech and he didn't pick him. And the current coach, Walid Regragui, he actually went after Ziyech, made him like a sort of the player, the pivot, like the player around whom you organize the team. So if you have somebody who identifies with the nation, who sees this as a project of the country, then I think you get better outcomes.
Yeah, so you're saying in a lot of cases it's a cultural disconnect when a European coach steps into, say, the Cameroonian national team.
I mean, yes, of course I argue that, but I do think there are some exceptions. So in one case, there was a coach, Bruno Metso, who was actually the coach of that Senegal team that went to the 2002 World Cup and went to the quarterfinals. He was French, but he identified with, you know, the Senegalese project. In fact, some people argue that the way that Senegal's football is currently organized, the way the national team plays, the structures, these are all inherited from Metsu. Metsu also converted to Islam. He was married to a Senegalese woman. And in fact, he sadly died of cancer and he's buried in Senegal. So not every European coach is necessarily a mercenary or just trying to take the money and jumping around. There are exceptions.
So as you said earlier, many of the best players from African countries play in top European leagues. There's a lot of money there. How does that affect not just the development, but also the style of soccer across Africa?
One of the things about modern football is that the style of football increasingly was kind of becoming a sort of a uniform style. Everybody was almost playing, if you want, like the top five European leagues. So if you like the way you play in Spain or in England, in France. But when African players first went to those leagues, they were in the kind of more marginal positions. They were either just sort of enforcers in defense. They might just be like a striker up front. But more and more, they become like the player around whom coaches organize things. So you began to see an African player becoming like the star, Mohamed Salah, Sadio Mane, Yaya Toure.
We got to mention the fans, too, fans of the national teams across the African continent. They are part of the story. What is the desire for high-level soccer across Africa?
I mean, the desire is for more and more for people to be able to, you know, for fans to identify with the team and turn up for football games. But in most cases, African fans, you know, they're not able to have that connection to the team. Of course, cost, things like that are involved, facilities and so on. But what I like about this World Cup, because it's in the Arab world, and in a place like Qatar, which I was checking earlier, it has exemptions, visa exemptions for at least 95 countries. So that makes it much easier for you to get to the World Cup if you're from an African country. But if you play like this World Cup in Qatar and you have your fans there, so for Morocco, it's like a home game. You might see the teams feel lifted and, you know, play better.
So I think it's fair to say the progress for African national teams, it's noticeable, but it's slow. Are you confident, Sean, that things will continue on an upward trajectory to the point that we will see an African team win the FIFA trophy someday soon?
At this point, probably you do this thing where you still live vicariously through African players who, you know, the children of immigrants who play for kind of European teams, whether it's France, but also you can live through Brazil if you want. If you get the best of the players that you get from Europe and combine them with the players who play in the local league, then hopefully we can start challenging for places in semifinals and finals, yeah?
Sean Jacobs is an associate professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. He also runs the popular blog, Africa's a Country. Great to talk this over with you, Sean. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
As an international news show, we cover crises around the world, but we also like to tell stories about the people who show up in a crisis to help. That's where you come in. For an upcoming special edition of The World, we're looking for stories about helpers. We want to hear about people who made a difference in your life when times are tough. Send us a short voice memo with your story about someone who came through for you and how they had your back, what they did to help. Include your name and location and send your voice memo in an email to myworld@theworld.org. We might feature your story on the show. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Hi, Marco Werman here with a quick word before we go. Earlier, you heard from reporter Shirin Jafari. She was telling you how your contribution supports our international coverage, like her ongoing reporting on the war in Ukraine. If you value the coverage that Shirin brings, I hope you'll consider donating and bringing us one step closer to unlocking our $67,000 match. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.
From PRX.